You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics. In this week's episode, which continues our month of shows looking at comic book shops, we have a couple of interviews showcasing very different ways of buying comics in the UK. Later in the show, Dickon Harris is talking to Mike Lake and Colin Strawbridge about their regular stall at the Royal National Hotel Comic Mart, which takes place every month near Russell Square. Before that, I'm talking to Peter Renshaw, the co-owner of a new graphic novel shop called Plan B in Glasgow. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Peter Renshaw, co-owner of Plan B Comics in Glasgow. As far as I could tell from the photos that you show me of your shop and the discussion we've had about it, it specialises in graphic novels rather than monthly serialised comics.
Yes.
And presumably you thought that that was a gap in the market.
Yes, that's correct. Tom and myself had both come to the same conclusion that most comic shops didn't represent independent graphic novels in particular, and even some trade paperbacks very well, and that the shelves tended to be crowded out, and we wanted to do it in a different way.
Mm. What's the, in terms of if one was to go to Glasgow to buy comics, what's the sort of selection of shops that you might find there? I believe there's a Forbidden Planet.
There's a Forbidden Planet in Buchanan Street, which has been there for several years. There's also the shop that was set up by a character called John McShane, which almost everyone's heard of, called AKA Comics originally. He and his partner Pete Root sold it on. It's now A1 Comics. Mm. But the windows tends to have Lego and toys in, so it makes its money more. In fact, there's two branches of A1. There's another one on the outskirts of Glasgow. But they tend to make their money out of collectibles and kids' games, really.
So therefore, you're appealing to quite a different market if you're going to concentrate on graphic novels and push them as, you know, a media that has excellent art and literature rather than a shop that also sells toys and T-shirts. And I guess your clientele that starts to come in, you've noticed that there is enough of a different market for you to exist in that marketplace.
Yeah, I think there's an enthusiastic market. I'm just hoping it's big enough to sustain the shop. I mean, we're about 9 months down the way now. We're holding our own, but we're not exactly making a great profit yet. But yeah, that was the idea. And the people who come in and the kind of books they buy would indicate there is a need.
Because if you go to a regular bookshop like Waterstones, for example, they do have a graphic novel section, but it always seems to be quite haphazard and not particularly well curated. Do you find customers coming to your shop and say, oh, we've been to regular bookshops and they don't seem to really know what to advise in terms of having read this graphic novel, try this one, so we've come to you?
Well, the Waterstones, which is closest to us, is the one at the other end of Argyle Street from where we are. And they recommend people to come down to us.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Not only that, we've had some sort of influence on them insofar as they've started to try and label their bookshelves autobiographical, historical and so on, which is what we do naturally.
Because I noticed, I was impressed in the photos that you showed me that you have an entire bookcase just devoted to Love and Rockets and its spin-offs, which shows that actually if you've got a strong enough band that you can actually make an entire range based around it.
Yes, I think with Love and Rockets, that came about organically. We just discovered that people were coming to us all the time looking for more and more Los Bros, Hernandez-related material. And so it's ended up in the entire shelf. So we might as well label it Love and Rockets.
And the exception to your rule about stocking graphic novels is indie comics. What's your criteria for which indie titles you stock? Is it as much that creators approach you and say, will you take my wares?
We very rarely refuse anything. I'm not even sure if we have. I mean, we take a look at it and think, have an opinion on it. If it was something that we felt was deeply offensive in some way, we might refuse it. But in general, we put it on the shelf and we're happy to. And in fact, it sells quite well. It's an easy trade for us because they're all on sale or return, so there's no outlay. And so we try and display them as well as we'd display anything else.
So how would you describe... I mean, you probably don't have an average customer, but do you have people who come in, say, looking for crime graphic novels, looking for sort of more humorous ones? Is it more that people who have an interest in graphic novels are more interested in the medium and so will try a broad range of different genres within it?
I think there are some people who come in who really do have an interest in what we should, what we call sequential art. Others have a specialist interest. Batman stays popular, and people look for all sorts of obscure things in Batman. So we have a section which we label adventure. We don't call it superheroes, but a fair amount of it is actually good Batman stuff.
Okay. So you do stock superhero comics, but say we curated around particular writers and artists.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and also, I mean, we're well aware that we've had support early on from Mark Miller. It would be silly not to stock a few Mark Miller trade paperbacks in the shop, and likewise Grant Morrison and anything drawn by Frank Quietly, because they're all local to us.
And you mentioned Mark Miller. He's someone who's done a signing in your shop before.
Mark. Just opposite us, there's something called the Modern Institute, which is a gallery. Mark happened to be visiting there on a Saturday or Sunday, I forget now, and came out and saw us and walked straight over into the shop. Fortunately, as he was coming across the road, I recognised him and said, "Hello, Mark." He thought he knew me, or I thought. Anyhow, it worked. And he then offered to do a Miller World in the shop and tweeted about us, and we had a good day.
Looking at the layout of your shop, it does seem to be a space actually that you can fit a fair number of chairs in. So when you do signings, do you do some kind of panel discussions as well in there?
Yeah, yes, we do. We invested in a projector, and so we can dim the lights down, put a screen up, and give proper talks. And we borrow some chairs from from an institute round the corner, but where I also have a studio, and it works out fairly well. Yeah, we can fit 30, 35 people in the shop quite comfortably just by moving the tables out of the way.
So what sort of creators have you had coming in to talk in your venue?
We started off with Denise Mina, went just after a sickness in the family came out. Then we had Brian Tolbert. Brian had offered to come up, and we shared Brian's visit with Forbidden Planet Edinburgh. So he did a book signing there in the morning, came over and delivered a talk with the projector in the afternoon. We've had sci-fi writers. I'm not an expert at Tom's side, and I'm not quite an expert on who they were. Where they were. More recently, we had Metafrog in, John and Sandra. Cool. And they also gave a talk, illustrated talk, with the projector. And we're hoping to have Ben Tablesmith. It seems it's going to go ahead because he's coming up to Leeds and then he's touring Scotland and had already heard of us. So he's volunteered. If we can give him and his friend a bed for the night or a couple of rooms in a hotel, he's going to do a book signing with us.
And outside of co-owning a comic shop, you're a comic book creator yourself. You've contributed to the Dead by Dawn anthology from Scar Comics, and I believe you're working on a Burke and Hare graphic novel?
Completed the Burke and Hare graphic novel over a year ago. Yes, okay. You're right, I did contribute to Dead by Dawn. Forgotten about that. I'm currently working on a story about a character called Morgan Quinn, who I created at least a decade ago, and I've got a pile of about 500 Bristol boards which have never gone anywhere, and I'm now sort of cannibalising them. I work on a Wacom Sadiq, and I'm beginning to turn them into something modern and a slightly different story. But that's why I'm waiting for Martin Conaghan, who also did a book on Burke and Hare, to come back with a script. We're going to work together on a story on Deacon Brodie, the Edinburgh councillor and thief, who was hanged in 1780, whatever it was. But that's Martin's side script.
Were you aware that Martin was also doing a Burke and Hare graphic novel when you did yours? Or was there friendly rivalry between the two productions?
I was aware of it fairly early on, but I was already committed. And apart from the fact it was a bit of a race to see who would finish first. And there was two of them and only one of me. They won, not by much, but they did win. I've become good friends with Martin and with the artist Will Pickering. So it was completely the opposite. We both understood that it was no one's fault. We both hit on the same idea.
We're at Caption today, and a couple of the people who are selling comics in stalls in the dealer's room, for want of a better word, Will Morgan and Al Davison are also comic book creators. And I'm wondering just how many shops around the country that sell comics actually have creators behind the counter. Do you think that there is a little bit of a unrealised desire there for a lot of people that you make comics, but also you love comics and therefore you want to actually kind of impose your taste on other people by curating the contents of your own shop?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
I'm well aware, of course, that Al's got his shop and he's been a creator for many years and a powerful artist he is as well. In my case, it was only because I inherited some money and I was in a position to make the investment. And Tom, my partner in business, Tom Green, who used to run a magazine called Dangerous Inks, which you may remember. Dangerous Inks folded because Borders went down, and that was the main distribution point. And he'd come up with the idea of opening a graphic novel shop. I had that idea. I was going to do mine in Edinburgh. Tom had already lined up our space, which is a railway arch in Glasgow. And it just made sense to combine forces. I had the money, and he'd done the business plan and got the site. So we took it from there.
And your shop also includes a cafe, am I right in thinking?
We do coffee.
Okay.
And we do coffee and cookies. I won't put it any further than that. It's not a cafe.
But that combination, do you find that it actually attracts a few more casual visitors who might sit and browse through some graphic novels while having a coffee and a cookie?
Well, Tom is a cook, good cook, and he really enjoys that. And he really likes good coffee. Mm. And so it's a special interest of his to make sure the coffee is the best it is. And we're in Merchant City end of Glasgow, and we have a sign outside saying the best coffee in Merchant City. Mm-hmm. And I think that's correct.
And because of that, do you think you've managed to create some new graphic novel readers on the side?
I would like to think so. I think what Tom had in mind when we opened was there'll be a lot of morning trade people going to work picking up cups of coffee. But we're not quite on that foot. We don't have that footfall. But what's happened is that people in and around, we have recording studios and galleries near us. People come in mid-afternoon for a conference in the shop. It's quiet. They can have a cup of coffee in the chat, and that's fine. And that extends for them browsing the shop as well.
Cool. Right. Thank you very much.
That's brilliant.
To find more info about Peter's shop, Plan B Books, please go to www.planbbooks.co.uk. And Peter's graphic novel, Burke and Hare, The Westport Murders, published by Driftwood Books, is available from all good bookshops. Next, here's Dick and Harris's interview with Colin Strawbridge and Mike Lake about their stall at the Royal National Hotel Comic Mart.
Hello, this is Dick and Harris. I'm at the Comics Mart, which is the Royal National Hotel by Russell Square Station. I'm joined here today by two veterans of the scene, I think it's fair to say.
We're so old.
Mike Lake from Titan Publishing. Got that right?
Not now, many years ago.
Okay. One of the founders.
Nothing to do with me now.
Okay, fine. But stalwart of the scene and his colleague.
Colin Strawbridge.
Okay. I mean, really, it's quite, for people who don't know, about comics, who aren't familiar with comics, they might see a comic shop and they might see current issues and there's display like a newsagent, effectively. But the Comic Mart collects back issues, you've got rare collector's editions, it's very different and very, I'd say, what I was first struck by was how much there is, but also quite how little as well. I mean, 70% of this stuff is dominated by Marvel reprints and that sort of thing.
And DC.
And DC, of course, sorry. The big two.
Marvel and DC.
But what you do find is that there's lots of extremely high-end comics for about a couple of £100 or £50-60. I mean, what drives that price? What makes a single floppy issue that would have sold, I don't know, a reprint, so you can say, get for £2.50 an hour for £400.
It's got to be something that's in your mind. Either you care that it's a reprint, or you don't care that it's a reprint. I'm a big vinyl collector, so is Colin here. I think to myself, why do I want to buy a CD of the first Beatles LP? I want to buy the first Beatles LP. Why? That's because it's us. That's what we do.
I think it was the advent of price guides back in the 70s that kind of kick-started the direct market anyway. You know, before that, comics were only available on newsstands. And then a guy called Phil Suling, back in about 1971, had the idea that instead of people having to go around newsstands and buy them, he could set up a central warehouse and sell comics by volume to retailers who cared for them. After that, it was inevitable with the price guides that there'd be some kind of speculation about them. It comes and goes.
It was happening before Phil. It was happening before the direct market, definitely, because there were dealers in the United States in the 60s, and prices were heading into the double figures in the 60s. I remember the very first Golden Age comic I got, Witness Number One, 1948. It was $3, 30 shillings, something like that. And I had to debate with my mum for ages as to whether I could spend that much money on one comic book.
Wow. And how much is that worth now, do you reckon?
I don't know. Witness One turns out to be dead rare.
Perhaps you could have been out with them.
But Witness One, what's Witness One worth now?
And
isn't it rare?
I've never heard of it.
You've never seen it, you've never heard of it.
It must be a modern comic.
No, 1948, timely.
Oh.
Okay, but
this is rarefied stuff, mate.
Rarefied stuff.
It is, but the danger is the old saying, the price of everything and the value of nothing. So many investors have bought and held on to comics and hoping they're going to go up in value. But suddenly something strange will come along where a worthless comic will suddenly
jump up in price.
Purely for very strange reasons. Okay, well, just got one here. Here is a very ordinary comic, Superboy 78 from 1960. Nothing special about it at all. Nice Kurt Swan cover.
Yeah.
Nothing special about
it. This original reprint. This is the original.
No, this is the original. Okay. Oh yeah, no, this is the original comic, which probably would, in the old days, be worth round about £15, maybe £20.
Suddenly.
But somebody suddenly realised that the first story in here involves a sex change, whereby Superboy meets an alien who mind reads him. Now, this alien is a lady who's driving rather badly.
Oh, right, okay.
Typical women drivers.
It's true, all over the universe.
Yes. She gets upset and turns him by her magical powers into a girl. So it's a gender-changing...
You know, I've never heard of this one.
Here it is.
Yeah.
Here it is. And suddenly, from Clark Kent, she becomes Claire Kent.
You could say it's a manufactured collectible.
To a certain sense, this Mark Kent says, "Well, I'm delighted. I've always wanted a daughter."
That is totally bizarre. I've never seen.
You can't change the Clark's clothes, so I'll go shopping for you.
This just reminds me why I never did like Superman.
I was gonna say,
I never liked him.
It's utterly bizarre.
It was
bizarre.
Always nonsense.
But of course, one of the worrying things is this was also innocent. These comics were aimed at 8 to 12 year olds. That was the target audience. Superboy was, we all guess, he's about 12 when he's performing this. He's about 12. So this girl is about 12. Trouble is, she's got the attributes of a 12-year-old girl. Now, if you were 12 and you were turned into a girl, what would you do?
This is Tales of Nightmare, which imagine for
exactly,
the average reader.
Exactly. It is. The rest of the stories are incredibly ordinary about the origin of Superboy's costume and so forth. But this first story, And when somebody suddenly discovered, hey, this is a transgender, this is... At the time, it was a sweet, innocent little story.
Yeah, and then...
But a few years ago, somebody cottoned on to what it was, and its price has and collectability has rocketed.
So how much is it worth now?
Well, I've got it up for sale at £45.
£45. That's quite expensive, but I've seen some comics over there for £200 or £300.
Well, the most expensive comic I've
got... £150.
£1,800. I'm holding in my hands a copy of The Amazing Spider-Man... This is Amazing Spider-Man 2. Okay, so this is off the famous one with the front cover and swinging. This is him versus the Vulture. It's in a strange, it's in a metal case. It's just got a... What is this case?
These are called slabbing, where they slab comics and grade them.
Okay, and why is this rating? What's this about? Can you explain this?
This way, you get a guaranteed graded comic, so you know that in you know exactly what condition it's in. You know what the price should be. These are often artificially priced higher than the standard comic at that price, and you do pay for the grading and the slabbing.
But what I understand is, who does this then? Who does the grading?
This company's CGC Universal Graders.
So somebody came around, picked up this comic, and said, verify that it was true.
You pay them to grade the comic for you and slab it in vinyl.
And that's it. So does it?
That comic's anyone... too late to interest.
Okay, so
I have no interest.
So would anyone actually read this? Would it ever be open?
They generally, once they're slabbed, they're there to be collected, not to be read.
Can you open it? Is it possible to open it?
I certainly wouldn't like to open it.
But you can be opened if possible. Be.
No.
That's it.
No, it's slabbed. If you wanted to break it, but then you'd be destroying the grading of it if you opened it.
Wow! So this is pretty much an encased comic. It's never going to be opened. It's never going to be read.
No, it can be opened. It can be read.
It can be read.
It can be read. Yeah.
Basically,
what it means is that if, for instance, this gentleman said, "I want an Amazing Spider-Man number 2. I know it's an expensive book.
Yeah.
I know it is, but I don't want a restored copy. I want an unrestored copy that's been independently graded. He can pay me this, he'd get a discount, obviously. But he'd take it home, and he could crack the slabbing.
Right.
Open it up and take out the comic. However, what most people do, who buy slab comics, is they will buy a higher-grade slab comics to keep and love and adore, but they will then buy themselves a low-grade, maybe a pence copy, maybe a good plus copy, a bit of a tatty copy, to read, knowing that they've got the high-grade copy in their collection.
Let me just ask you about this particular comic. So you bought this comic, and how did you acquire it? Because this must have been second issue Spider-Man. You know, it's already getting quite... It must have been quite expensive even sort of 30 years ago, or 20 years ago. And did you just collect it as a kid? Did you just have it? Or how did you come across it?
As a kid, I did have an edition of this, but I didn't have this one.
How did you get this one then?
I bought it as part of a collection. I bought a collection off somebody.
Okay. And how much would an original comics collection like that go for if people are selling whole collections? Bear in mind, this went for £1,850.
Well, it all depends. The most I paid for a collection is £22,000.
£23,000. Wow. So there's some... Wow, okay. So these are...
But it was one heck of a collection.
Yeah, I bet. So...
But... The numbers I'm talking about are nothing compared to what Harley Yeen there does.
Yes, he's another collector in the market.
He'll pay $100,000 for a collection if the right books are in it.
And Metropolis more.
I'm an amateur compared to these guys. Mm. I just do this part-time as fun.
Yeah.
Guys like Harley, they do it for a living.
It's the American dealers.
I couldn't do that. It's too worrying. I love comics too much to be able to make a living out of it. A
copy of Action Comics number 1 went for £1,100,000 recently.
I'd crack the slabbing.
Not if I'd have to pay extra, you don't know.
But I've got to ask a question then. In terms of these high-end volumes, I mean, what's the norm? Because there are only so many of those sort of issues that are floating around. I look around, most of these sort of rare first-rate editions are about £50. The Golden Age comics, is that right?
No, way out.
You can't You're say a line. Out. You cannot no. come with a line like that. They're all over from you can from go next to nothing to tens and tens and tens and tens and tens.
He's
of
absolutely
thousands.
Right. It will
There's
all
no
vary.
Rhyme or reason.
It will all vary. Yeah. what the comic title is, who the illustrator is, who the writer is, what the condition is.
Okay, so, but for example, I mean, I asked somebody today and I was looking around and they said that Walking Dead now, the original, you know, it's a fairly new comic series. Number one from The Walking Dead is now worth £200 for the first edition. And if you think £200, you could buy the whole of that run, which is about for about 20 quid or so, 30 quid. And you're shaking your head.
I just can't be getting on with these prices for new comics, personally.
Yeah,
just
me,
personally.
Is that because they're what? Because they you can just get the book so easily? Or
they're artificially high because they've got fame on the television. So they're artificially high, the same way the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles went skyrocketing when the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film came out.
Well, that's right. You'll have an issue. There's a Thor movie out now. Some dealers will suddenly think, right, it's a Thor movie, let's up the prices of my Thor comics.
This is exactly what happened with Michael Jackson, God help us, when he died. People were paying three figures for copies of Thriller. Give me a break.
Mm. Yeah, okay, fair enough. So
it's exactly the same sort of thing. Okay.
There is a lot of Emperor's New Clothes.
All right, fair enough. So lots of
But not all of it is.
Okay.
Only some of it is.
Well, I mean, the thing I find most interesting about the comic market, to be honest, is the fact that I go to the comic shop, I see Marvel, DC, I see the superhero show. It's really interesting to see this pre-superhero stuff, which is you know, the sort of wealth of comics, what comics used to be. And that's the real benefit for me coming to this. And especially you've got Mike, you're about to say something.
I was going to say, you're talking to three people who actually do love and appreciate the entire history of this stuff. Now, not every youngster that's going to get involved is going to follow backwards. But many are. Many sentient thinking young people do actually want to see where this wonderful stuff came from, like you can do with music as well.
When you were a 12-year-old,
you might be into Metallica
and you bought comics.
Check out what went on before Metallica. It's the same mindset.
Yeah, but when you were a 10 or 12-year-old kid, same as me, same as all of us here, and you bought comics, were you concerned about the history of them, or did you just enjoy what you were buying?
Let me think. For about 30 seconds, I was not interested. After that, I was. Yeah, I absolutely wanted to know where they came from. I did, personally.
So,
from minute one.
You bought, I'm guessing now, but you bought things like the 80-page Giants, or the Marvel Annuals.
The 100-page Spectaculars were popular when I started.
And it said reprinted from Adventure Comics number 17. You thought, oh, God, I want to know what Adventure Comics 17 is like.
Hang on, guys, these are all Marvel stories from the 70s, aren't they?
Could be DC, could be...
In England, we had British black and white reprints of a lot of this stuff as well. And for a youngster, it's very confusing. We buy our nice American colour comics, and look, here's the same comics, but it's thicker, and it's British, and it's in black and white. And then slowly, you know, you're 8 years old, it takes you a little while to work out, the Brits are reprinting the American stuff.
Yeah.
When you've got that realisation, you can start maybe divining back in the history, looking at the black and white reprints. There was a wonderful day. I found a black and white British reprinty comic, and it reprinted the most wonderful mid-1950s Marvel comic. It was called Young Men 24, which featured the origins, brand newly written and drawn, of Submariner, Captain America, and the Human Torch. And I was made up, because all of a sudden I know where these characters came from.
Oh, right, and this is before the reprints, when you had... Because that's the thing that's changed about this, is that now I can pick up the sort of essential collections where you have reprints of the first, you know, I don't know, the Jack Kirby one or the Fantastic Four, you know, it's quite a well-known one. Has that changed this before? Because before you get people coming in just because they want to read the stories. Now is it more about the collectors, but from the sheer point of... They don't care so much about the story, they want to have it in their hands again?
To a certain extent, the people that come to comic marts want to buy the back issue comics for their actual collection.
Okay.
A number of people come along and look around for cheap reprints, of course, because there will be some. But most people are coming here for original, proper stuff.
I'll buy a lot of reprints, and there's some nice ones around now. There are a lot of Mahal covers, or you can buy the big essential editions, which you get 500 pages of old comics for £7 or £8.
The Marvel Essentials, like the first 24 Fantastic Fours for a tenner, the biggest bargain on earth. There is nothing that you can spend 10 quid on where you'll get more fun.
A lot of them are going online now as well. Starting in September, DC are releasing 50 brand new number one comics. and all of them are going online immediately as soon as they're published.
Okay. Well,
and that's going to be the first time that a publisher's actually been keeping up with the comics they're releasing and putting them online simultaneously so people can read them on their iPhones or, you know, PCs, whatever.
What's the market happening to the market now? Because, you know, obviously you showed me that sort of comic that's £1,850. Bear in mind, you can't get
my wife
more comics to come up. Are these things only getting more and more expensive? Is it becoming
same as collecting anything else? The top of the top, the cream of the cream, will carry on increasing in value exponentially, and the lesser condition and the lesser things are slowly dwindling down to nothing. Exactly the same as book collecting, exactly the same as record collecting.
What about eBay? Because that's changed this completely, hasn't it? Does the advent of eBay and Amazon sort of affected these sort of collectors?
No, I think by the time eBay came out and Amazon, I think we'd already had several speculator-driven peaks and troughs. And there'd been a few big crashes, and I think by the time the computer age hit, people were wised up to
crashes.
For example, in 1993 there was a big speculator boom, and people were investing heavily in number one issues that were currently being published, and consequently people got left with 500-600 copies, whole boxes full that they'd invested in and were theoretically worthless.
And now
in a little period of 5 or 6 years where the hot comic was invented, where small print run number one suddenly are perceived as being, oh, this is the next big collector's item, I have to have one. Oh, but there was only 1,000 printed. The first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was the comic that did this. The guys printed it themselves at home, more or less as a fanzine, and within a couple of weeks it's worth like $100 or whatever, because it suddenly got... Everyone loved it, and there were hardly any copies. So they're genuine collectible. Genuinely, you got to pay a lot of money to buy one of the few things that were printed. Well, immediately, of course, particularly Americans, everyone jumps on the bandwagon, and all of a sudden there's an entire industry in small print run number ones, which are hot. I mean, I could tell some stories, which I am not going to tell, of people fiddling it.
Oh, really?
Basically reprinting something, making it hot, and then reprinting it a couple of thousand.
Ooh,
I mean, I know for a fact. But by the early 90s, Image Comics had started. Another story all of its own, but Image started with a bunch of number ones. There was the X-Men number one as well that came out from Marvel, and the Spider-Man number one that came out from Marvel, new number ones. And all the teenagers in America were buying crates of these things, 300 at a time, because they knew all they had to do was put them up in their loft, and that's their house paid for down the line. For an absolute fact, you said the 1993-94 boom and bust.
Yeah.
1994, I was in my shop in Los Angeles, and overnight you see the marketplace fall apart around you. All these kids, it was summer, it was 3-4 years since they'd bought their 300 X-Men ones. They're now 18-19, it's time to really put some fuel in the car or travel to Europe. Let's sell the 300 X-Men ones for $500 each. They bring them into us. We can't even give them 10 cents each because we've got 1,000 left ourselves. 8 million of that comic was sold.
Okay.
Yeah. And the average print
and
run of
that
it is
was the day that all of those teenagers stopped buying their comic books. And that summer, the entire industry almost collapsed worldwide.
Roughly at the same time, there was a comic published by DC called Elseworlds Finest.
Okay.
Now, this particular comic was nothing special about it at all.
It was very Batman ordinary. And Superman, isn't it?
It had Batman, Superman, and a few other characters in, and there was a story in there about Super Baby.
Okay.
Now, this is Superman as a baby.
Is this drawn by Steve Rude?
Super Baby goes into a microwave.
What?
And gets zapped in a microwave. Possible lawsuits. So what happens is DC withdraws every single copy and they are all pulped. The lot. so they think. But about 150 of them were shipped over to the UK.
Oh, wow, OK.
And you know what? I never heard this one.
And these comics were in the comic shops in the UK. I bought one because I like Elseworlds. And Elseworlds Finest is a rubbish comic. The stories are bad, the art's bad. It's just not very good at all. And because it was pretty bad, I thought, oh, I'll just bag and board it and I'll stick it in my 50p box on the mart. But I happened to come in here and I saw that Krypton Comics had one on their board. And I thought, why on earth has he got that on? And he told me the story. I thought, oh, right, I shall keep it. They now go for about $150. They've peaked at about $150. There's a limited quantity of them, but because it's such a rubbish comic...
Okay, so there's a value even in the rarity.
Unless you are a complete completist, you're not going to want it. So it's rare, but it's a bit of a freak. And it's a
manufactured collectible in many ways.
It is, but at least it's rare. There's a story behind it, and it's genuinely rare. And it can never be reprinted, because Warner Brothers, who own DC, don't want to be sued for children walking into microwaves. But if anybody buys a comic as an investment, I think they're a fool.
Still, even now. So if I
buy a comic because you like it, because you want to enjoy it, you enjoy the writer, you enjoy the artwork, and it may go up in value.
Okay.
But don't buy it purely as an investment.
I'm just curious. I mean, I'm curious about some of these other peaks. 93-94 was obviously a big one, and that was really the publisher's fault for being. They saw what was happening, and they just went nuts with it. Have there been any other ones? Are there other peaks and troughs?
There's the latest thing's been alternative covers on comics.
Oh yeah, that's going to mention that. Go on.
Yeah, so you'll get the publishers will do 5, 10, 15, 20 alternative covers on a comic book. Some of them not even remotely related to the story within the comic.
Okay. Zombie variants and that kind of thing.
Zombie variants, that kind of thing. Yeah. I've seen those things up for £200 on the walls of comic shops, and, you're a fool if you buy any of those, in my opinion.
Is it because... is there a rarity value there? I mean, are they restricted to printing? How many variant covers do they do for... Let's say, I don't know, the average Batman story has 4 different variant covers. Mike's taking his head here. He recognises the publisher's
weeds.
This is
why I left the business. I don't want to be in a business of manufactured collectibles. It's almost confidence trickstery. Almost. Okay. It isn't, but it's not that far off it. It's just not what I came to do. I came to point out to the world how great reading your stories in comic book form was.
Absolutely. You know,
simple as that.
But it's interesting that there's enough of a market. Let's face it, they're not going to bother commissioning this artwork or gearing up if there isn't a market for collectors. So is there much interest in alternative covers here? I don't see many, to be honest. But
the Americans fall for this a little bit more than the British do.
It's very true. Yeah, I think without being anti-American, that's a fair comment.
Alright, okay. So if I wanted to, let's say I want to invest now, you know, I'm somebody who likes comics and appreciates some of the best stuff. If you buy good comics, basically pre the 60s, then you're doing quite well. If you think it's a good story,
I think even the 70s is a very collectible decade these days. The horror comics of the 70s were excellent, and you can go around today. I've seen you can pick up black and white Marvel comics.
That's exactly what I was going to say. The black and white Marvel magazines from the 70s are A, absolutely fantastic, B, not desperately common, because we didn't bring many into the country, did we?
No.
And C, not that expensive at this point.
No, you can pick them up for £1 or £2 each for quite a lot of them. They're great investment. Yeah.
And great to read.
Yeah.
Deadly Hands of Kung Fu and Savage Tales.
Okay, this rings a bell. And is it the ones where they had Fantastic Four at the beginning of it? And sometimes they had these other stories as well, aside? Or are you talking about those?
No, these are purely genre magazines.
Yeah.
Action Adventure or...
They were an early attempt to appeal to the mature market, because obviously comic readers have been getting older and older. The average age of a comic reader now is 47. And the black and whites were an attempt to keep people reading comics past their adolescence. Okay. So, you know, they were aimed at grown-ups, they featured more graphic violence, sex scenes, nudity, and they weren't governed by the Comics Code Authority, which was following the 50s horror comic nasties. They introduced a thing called the Comics Code Authority, which pretty much sanitised every comic you could buy until Marvel and a publisher called Warren, back in the late 60s, printed these as a way of getting around the Comics Code Authority.
And they're not bad either. They're not like too rude, and they're not too graphically violent. They were great. They pitched it quite nicely.
One thing I don't notice when I walk around here is
one of Barack Obama's favourite reads as well.
What was?
Yeah, he's Savage Sword of Conan.
No, really?
Was one of Barack Obama's, his favourite comic. He's mentioned it.
You know the irony though, there is Barbarian, Barack
the Barbarian.
Yeah.
Which is a spoof for Conan. Story with
That's what inspired it. Now we like the Savage Sword of Conan comics.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
Savage Swords were wonderful because Roy Thomas put them together effectively as a tribute to Robert E. Howard, the greatest fantasy author of all time.
Okay.
And they were just generally fabulous, those magazines. All the artists put in their best work. There was some great stuff in them, and not expensive.
We buy the collections now with black and white reprints.
Yeah, £13 for 500 odd pages of black and white Savage Sword of Conan. It's again, as Mike said about the Fantastic Four earlier, a real bargain.
That's such collections. One thing I'm not noticing when around here, though, there's many European comics. I know it's because we're sort of UK, it's a language thing, but is there a collector's market of European stuff? Does that exist in the same way?
Not in the same way at all. No.
Why?
It's something I don't know much about. When we used to own Forbidden Planet and we were doing all the Titan stuff, we were always trying to bring in European stuff and try and broaden out the demand for this stuff. Never made it. We could never sell very much. Occasionally, as Titan Books, we reprinted some European stuff in English, and we tried very, very hard to sell it, but it never really quite got it to stick. No. There's a slight difference of approach. It's just different.
So Tintin and Asterix remain a bit of an anomaly, really.
Mm.
Okay, I was just curious because, I think if I had sort of, issue one or something like IRS, you'd imagine there's a very popular French comic that's been translated, actually, but there's no market for that here. I could literally wave it around in the original. Would I get anything?
No. No. I brought some French stuff today just to see if anybody cared. And the only people that do care tend to be the other artists. Actually, because a lot of the European art is fabulous and different. So I brought some of the French books along. I knew Ryan and three or four of the other guys would look at them.
There was an American magazine called Heavy Metal Magazine.
Yeah.
And that was originally called Metal Herlan. And they printed a lot of the fabulous European strips. Rank Xerox Liberatore.
And let's be frank, heavy metal didn't really start selling in the United States till they started putting excessive nudity into it. It sells okay. It sells mostly to bikers and 7-Eleven type shops. It's not a big success to comic collectors.
Oh, right, so you see, it explains, probably creates a whole wealth of tattoos as well, inspired by it, thinking about it.
Kevin Eastman, the guy who invented the Teenage Turtles, he owns heavy metal now. And for an absolute fact, he sells about 100,000 of heavy metal pretty well outside of the comic book marketplace.
Wow.
But if you go to, like, Spain, some of the characters from those magazines are icons. You know, there'll be graffiti of them all over the place. They have big conventions. Angoulême in France is a convention that encompasses a whole village.
Is this a buyer's or a seller's market? That's what I mean, the comic industry. In terms of, like, isn't the buyer's...
It's both. It's a symbiotic relationship.
At the high end, I mean, there's no quick or easy answers to any of your questions, of course.
All right.
There are so many, so many subdivisions of the types of dealer, the types of buyer, the types of comic, the format of the comic, the age of the comic, so many subdivisions. What was the point? What, remind me your question again.
Just a buyer or seller's market.
For the last 25 years since I've been in the business, every now and again in comes some chancer who tries to start making an investor's marketplace in great comics. Who was that business that we tried to compete with us? What were they called?
Neptune?
No, Stateside.
Stateside?
They started trying to put together portfolios of collectibles for rich people and that sort of thing, like people do with wine or whatever.
Did it take off?
That screwed up. Of course it screwed up. But 20, 25 years later, actually, there's plenty of people making real money out of the investor-y type of world. And it's got more sophisticated and got a bit more clever. It annoys the hell out of me, but it works. I mean, some of my mates are spending six figures on stuff.
If you really...
I know someone who has invested six figures in a page of artwork, as I know someone who invested four figures in a Beatles single recently.
Right, okay, and that's probably a good analogy. I mean, it's the same impulse, the same thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we've the industry, Scottish Lennon and McCartney's as well. Yeah.
Since The Sun published its 100 most valuable records in the Sun newspaper recently, now everybody thinks their first edition of Please Please Me is worth 10 grand. Yeah. I hear it from all my record dealer friends. I wish that bloody Sun hadn't printed it. Everyone's bringing me in their scrap copies of Please Please Me and asking me for £10,000.
And much the same as when you go to the real big auctions, it's things like Lennon's handwritten lyrics for Let It Be, that kind of thing. That's what gets the real money. And original comic artwork is something that you can invest in quite confidently.
I'm amazed by it. I still think original comic art is fairly cheap here. When I see some of the pages, considering this is it's art, and a painting of the same size would, even a fairly contemporary painting of the same size would go for about, I don't know, £500-600 for a fairly new painter. I see original comic artwork going for £300.
Again, it depends. If it's an old Jack Kirby page, that's another thing. If it's a brand new page from a new artist he's drawing 30 pages a month.
Yeah.
There's a lot coming out.
Even so, I mean...
Until the artist has made his name, until the artist becomes collectible, then his artwork will be $100 or $200. But some artists, you can spend £500 to £1,000 on a Steve Ditko page. If one particular Spider-Man page ever came to market, it would pass a million. There's one or two pages that, if they ever turned up, I know they would pass a million. Because already people are paying $300,000-$400,000 for pages.
Yeah.
If one or two of the real top pages ever came up for sale, it would go for a fortune. As far as I know, they haven't really turned up in the marketplace yet.
Well, I mean, I imagine you guys, if you're thinking of getting rid of it, you talk to your buddies first. But
well, listen,
you guys
you
are
must
talking about swapping art, original art. I was pretty curious
You know, someone anonymously donated the artwork to the first Spider-Man to the Library of Congress a couple of years ago.
No.
Do you know that?
Wow.
Huge news at the time.
That's extremely generous as well.
A few of us think we know who it was and why. And it's all good. There's nothing underhand. It's all good. And I'm certainly not saying on the radio who it was. Do you know?
No.
I'll tell you later.
I'm thinking the original Spider-Man artist, Steve Ditko, mysterious person.
No, no, it wasn't him.
Yeah.
Anyway, the artwork is there, and they've treated it as a genuine piece of very important Americana.
Well, it has to be because it's so expensive.
Well, now they've just made it even more so by absolutely making sure that everyone knows this is a big occasion. They photographed it in great detail and put it on the internet for everybody, and it's like a huge item, big deal. I'd love to see it. Apparently, when you see the original artwork, there's a whole different logo pasted under the logo that we've seen. We've never seen underneath that logo, of course, because we've never seen it. I'm dying to see what that is. I haven't seen it yet myself.
Fantastic. Well, thanks a lot, guys. I mean, I appreciate you sort of taking me through the history of all this stuff. And, thanks a lot, and hopefully see you at another Comic Mart.
Okay.
For more info about the London Comic Marts, please go to tinyurl.com/London Comic Mart. At Gosh Comics, in their shiny new shop at No. 1 Berwick Street in Soho, on Saturday the 13th of August, acclaimed indie comic book artist Luke Pearson will be launching his new title, Everything We Miss, from 6 p.m. More info can be found at www.goshlondon.com. The weekend after that, Friday the 19th and Saturday the 20th of August, there's a two-day War Comics Festival at the Imperial War Museum in Lambeth. Friday the 19th starts as an academic conference, including presentations by Paul Gravett, Roger Sabin and Tim Pilcher, followed by an hour-long chat on stage by Pat Mills talking about his work. Pat Mills' talk is available as a separate ticket to the conference or included in the price of the whole day. Then on Saturday the 20th, there are a variety of individually ticketed events, including talks by David Collier, author of Chemo, who will also be doing a separate comics-making masterclass, Garth Ennis, who is chatting about his work in a rare UK Comics Festival appearance, and panels including the creators of Dougie's War and War the Human Cost talking about their publications, plus a free film screening at the end of the day. More info about all the above can be found at www.panelborders.com/events. Panel Borders was introduced and edited by Alex Fitch and recorded by Alex Fitch and Dickon Harris. You can find an archive of all previous episodes of Panel Borders at www.panelborders.wordpress.com, and there'll be a new episode broadcast and online at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.